Although this is really only a discussion of coupling, I will introduce a whole lot of new concepts here, and hopefully I won't, completely leave you confused. So just expect that there'll be a lot of new concepts that won't be pertinent to the discussion of coupling. If you don't get some of them, that's not a big thing. You should have on your screen a picture that is right smack in the middle of it that you can look at while I explain this to you. It's the reflex circuit radio. You'll see a little green box in the lower right-hand corner that says reflex circuit radio. I reference the part numbers rather than their values in this particular diagram. It would just be way too cluttered to try and put values in this. I think I'll begin with the battery, B1, and right below it is a switch that's over on the left-hand side. When the switch is closed, it creates a path to the battery's positive terminal to ground, making the battery power the circuit with respect to ground, a negative voltage. This is probably upside down to the way that you normally think. Most circuits you expect the top to be positive. But this is trying to remain historically accurate as best I can do it. The reflex circuit radio is the thing that made Sony of Japan, it put them on the map. Sony had a hard time getting transistors in the early days. Transistors were very expensive. He had to figure out a way to do it with as few of transistors as possible. There are a number of innovations in this circuit, and a lot of them are involved with coupling. So that's why I chose this circuit, to demonstrate some of the principles of coupling. First, I need to explain to you what a transistor is. Q1 and Q2 are both transistors. The vertical line that joins all three wires, the vertical line represents the solid-state material that is the transistor. The other wires intersecting into the vertical line represent the connection wires to the actual solid-state material. The arrow indicates several things. It indicates that that is the emitter as opposed to the collector above it that doesn't have an arrow. The emitter is just simply a wire bonded to one end of the solid-state crystal. Solid-state crystal is grown in an unusual way. They take some very small amount of impurity and add it into a mix that's forming otherwise relatively pure. We're talking maybe one part impurity in 10 to the 17th power, otherwise pure silicon. They deliberately add an impurity that has an extra valence electron momentarily to create a base region, and then they dump in gobs and gobs and gobs of more pure silicon so that they can grow the rest of the transistor. That was the method that was employed back then, as I understand it. Nowadays, we have other methods of doping, and we can control it in ways that allow us to build ICs. But they didn't know those things then. Transistors were incredibly difficult to make. And to make them reliably and make them work well. And they hadn't really figured out how to do that with silicon yet. They knew it could be done, but they really didn't quite have a handle on how to process that. They were using germanium. You can make a germanium transistor somewhat easier in an industrial process control environment. And they, because of their physics, are PNP devices for the most part. They didn't have NPN that is why the arrow faces toward the solid-state material. When you see an NPN transistor, the arrow is turned around the other way. If you look at a transistor with just a simple ohm meter, you know, and you measure what you can measure without really entertaining the magical characteristics of the device, what you see is from the collector to the base. The collector's on top in both of those transistors. And from the emitter, which is on the bottom, to the base, you see a diode that's going in the direction of the arrow. That is a device that conducts one direction. And so whenever you hook them up, emitter to base, you see a reading, but only in one direction. Same way for the collector. You can, between collector and base, you see a reading in one direction. Between the emitter and collector with an ohm meter, you basically see nothing, or nearly nothing. You see maybe leakage current if you have a really sensitive meter. But that's a neat way to test a device, to at least figure out approximately where the emitter, base, and collector are. You can't tell the emitter from the collector with that method, but at least you get some idea. It also tells you something about the polarity of the device. It tells you whether it's a PNP or an NPN, depending on which way the current flows. But beyond that, you're missing all of the really exciting stuff that a transistor does. The exciting thing that a transistor does is it's a current amplifier. When an electric current is fed into the base with respect to the emitter in the forward bias direction, and in this case, the base has to be negative to be forward biased because it's a PNP device, that current that goes in through the base into the emitter, the base is an incredibly thin region in the solid-state crystal. They make it as thin as they possibly can. The thinner, the better. If you make it just a few atoms thick, if you could, what will happen is whenever you stimulate the base region with the current, the emitter base diode forward biases, and it causes charges to flow from the emitter to the base region. If the base region is very, very thin, most of them never really get out of the base, out of the base region into the wire that's carrying the current, if there is somewhere else they can go. And if the collector turns out to have a more negative charge on it than the emitter has at that moment, by about a tenth of a volt at least, maybe many volts, but if it is just at least a tenth of a volt or so, those charges will stream right past that thin region, the base, right on into this very attractive negative part of the semiconductor crystal and out the collector. And the amount that they favor going that direction as opposed to going into the base. In other words, once the charges have been pulled into the base by applying current from the base to the emitter, once they get into that region, it's very easy for them to be distracted from where they were going to begin with and go flying on across. The ratio of the amount that they wish to go across as opposed to going into the base region is called the beta. The transistor beta is a gain factor, and it varies from transistor to transistor, even within a given lot. You look at the specifications, they're very loose on those specifications whenever they publish them in data books, because the transistors vary a lot, temperature affects them. I mean, there's like everything else in electronics, there's tolerances. But in the case of transistors, the beta can vary hundreds of percent. It's a very loose figure. So what they tend to do is they publish a typical value and a minimum value and sometimes a maximum value. And they say, just go with it. So your design of a transistor, you have to take that sort of thing into consideration. And I will get into that whenever I discuss transistors in depth. I'm only trying to give you just sort of a loose brush of what a transistor does. In this case, specifically for Q1, there is a negative charge that comes from the battery, goes up to the wire on the top, down through T2, which has an electrical wire that is the coil, goes into T1 and then into the collector of Q1. This provides a negative charge, something for the charges to be attracted away from the base region and on into the collector. If we stimulate the base with a small amount of current, a much larger amount of current will flow through the collector. And if you look at R1 and R2, what they're doing is providing a voltage divider. The ratio of R2 to the total R1 R2 combination multiplied by the 9-volt battery. The SB1 is a 9-volt battery. I think that's probably where 9-volt batteries came from, was the Sony transistor radio. And, you know, you had to have something to power them. Anyway, that's whenever they became popular. That voltage may be 2 volts, maybe 3 volts, probably not, somewhere in that range. We'll say, for sake of argument, that it's 2.5 volts is available across R2 from the 9-volt battery. And it's a fairly high impedance. I'm not going to go into that right now. We'll say 5K, the Thevenized resistance looking back. That voltage doesn't really have anywhere to go after it charges up C7. There's no other path than to go through the inductor, which is the loopstick antenna, and then into Q1. This provides a source of current for Q1 and its beta to amplify. And so whatever current flows through R3, a small percentage of it is actually coming from the base, and most of it is coming from the collector via T1 and T2. As it turns out, there is a junction drop in the emitter base region. Like any diode, it has, because of the physical characteristics of the device, there is a diode drop there that's how we refer to it, of approximately a half a volt. Naturally, germanium is lower. The PNP transistors they used then was something on the order of 0.3 volt. But we'll just say half volt for nice round numbers. And so if you start out with 2.5 volts across R2, by the time it gets through the transistor, there's only 2 volts available across R3. So R3 can be used to control how much current the transistor idles at. And that current then also flows nearly the same current through T1 and T2. There's very little current actually goes through the base because the beta is multiplying it. Okay, so now you have a picture in your mind of sort of a happy, steady state condition. Okay. By the way, Q2 is biased much the same way. You have a couple of resistors that set up a bias voltage, R6 and R7. R8 becomes the current limit voltage that stabilizes the circuit, and then there's a transformer on the Q2's collector. Anyway, back to Q1. The signal paths are what's really, really interesting about the reflex circuit. Whenever I figured out how this circuit worked, I was ecstatic. I was a kid at the time, but whenever I finally figured out how this circuit worked, I was just walking around in a cloud for days, because this is really a fascinating circuit. It's primitive, and by the way, Sony didn't invent this. Years and years later, I saw a prior design that used vacuum tubes to pull this off. It didn't really win a lot of favor because vacuum tubes by then were well entrenched in society, and they were already building super heterodyne radios and so forth that are much more selective. But if all you have is two amplifier devices to work with, the reflex circuit radio is a very special circuit. Okay, if you look at the transformers, T2 and T3 are laminated. You know, if you look at the core material, it's represented with multiple lines. T1 and the loopstick antenna are both represented as transformers with a single rod going through them. In this case, it's a ferrite. It has very good characteristics at high frequencies, which is why they use it. Loopstick antenna also has some other kind of interesting characteristics. It's an adaptation of coil antennas that were popular in vacuum tube radios. Basically, what you have is a tuned circuit. C1 is a variable capacitor, approximately 330 picofarad whenever it's dialed all the way in, whereas the low end of the radio dial, the 550 kilohertz, when you dial it all the way up to the upper end, you're probably something on the order of 10 picofarad or something like that. The capacitor C1 and its coil on the loopstick, the coil it's connected to, form a resonant circuit, and then there's a loosely coupled pickup coil, the bottom one, the one that's connected to Q1. And literally what happens is this ferrite rod, if it's aligned properly in the atmosphere, so that radio waves coming from the broadcast transmitter strike the thing edge-on, I guess, maybe, is maybe the West 8. In other words, your bar has to be crossways with respect to the transmitter. When a wave strikes that, it sets up a magnetic field inside the loopstick, which is then the resonant circuit of C1 and the coil around the loopstick tends to allow only one small frequency band to actually stimulate the antenna. So that's how you tune in a particular station. The pickup coil is somewhat loosely coupled so that the Q of the quality, if you want to call it that, of the coil capacitor combination, the sharpness of the resonance of those two can get the best advantage. But you do need to have something to pick up that signal, and so that there's that little loosely coupled, just a few turns of wire. Literally, I think these radios had like 4 turns of wire for that coil and several hundred for the other coil. Anyway, the bias voltage comes in from R2 through the coil into Q1, but now going through the coil and in the presence of the air and presumably tuned into a radio station, there's this RF that's tickling the DC voltage that's coming into Q1. So now Q1 receives a DC static, you know, input voltage, which translates into a current in R3, but that DC voltage being tickled with a variation of RF, the radio station that you're tuned into, causes current variation through R1. And because C3 is in parallel with R3, I should explain something else. Capacitors, whenever you see them with a curved line, indicate that they're polarized devices. And a polarized capacitor is not something you really want in your circuit if you can avoid it. Except that the only way that you get really large amounts of capacitance, generally you have to go to a different technology. You have to go to electrolytic capacitors or tantalum capacitors or something of that order to get the kind of large amounts of capacitance you want, and those are all polarized capacitors for the most part. They get real expensive if they're not. So the fact that you have a curved line that shows polarity on some of these capacitors also indicates that these are significantly larger in the microfarad sense. They have a lot more capacitance than the ones with just simple straight lines. And C3 has so much capacitance that it won't allow voltage changes even at the audio frequencies, or it blocks everything. In point of fact, I should mention that electrolytic capacitors, because of the way they're made, also have some inductance, and if you really want that, if you really want them to be good at RF frequencies, you really need to put a regular capacitor across them. But if I added all that to the schematic, it would make it terribly confusing. So I won't. I didn't. At any rate, if you look at C3, it tries to hold the voltage constant across R3. As it tries to hold the voltage constant, that RF that's tickling the base of Q1 gets translated into a whopping change in current by the time it goes out the collector. And since it's RF, the ferrite transformer, T1, works to absorb all of that. T1 is only a few turns of wire around a ferrite. It's no good at all. It doesn't have enough inductance to do anything at the audio range, but in RF, it's very, very good. It's a very good transformer, very good inductor. So the thing that makes T1 a transformer, of course, is that you have a coil. Yeah, you have two separate coils on the device, and they're both magnetically coupled to each other. The output of T1, the small winding, feeds a diode that is being forward biased by R4 coming from the battery. It's just providing a little bit of DC current to make sure that the diode is always biased. It'll drop about a half a volt also, just like the transistors do. It is the physics of a diode that's doing this. And C5, being a small capacitor, in other words, it doesn't have a curvy line. It's not a polarized device, so it's just an inexpensive little tiny capacitor, is only good at RF frequencies, which means that the diode that has an RF stimulus on it charges C5 positively in the opposite direction of the battery. In other words, the battery forward biases the diode to negative 1/2 volt, but there's a little bit of voltage on coming out of the diode that tends to push against that, go the other direction. It tries to put a positive voltage on C5, depending on how much amplitude is picked up out of the air by the station that you've tuned in. Okay, so the more amplitude, the more RF that's available, the more positive, the more opposite the direction of the battery, the more positive the voltage on C5 is. It probably never goes below zero, though. and audio frequencies to C5 are so slow that C5 is perfectly willing to allow voltage to build and collapse across its plates with very little current at the audio frequencies, which means that when the guy's at the transmitter end and he's talking and there's a microphone vibrating with his voice that gets picked up, and what it does is it controls how much RF, radio frequency, how much power at the radio frequency that the transmitter is putting into the air. And so whenever you get over here at this end, the diode is following that RF field strength wave. It's following that signal, and what ends up coming across C5 is reconstructed audio without the RF on it. Okay? Because C5 in effect decouples the RF, blocks it, and what's left over across C5 is, of course, the DC bias caused by the diode in R4, but also audio signal is present there. We then use a high capacitance capacitor, C6, to couple that audio into a potentiometer. A potentiometer is a resistor that has a wiper arm that can slide up and down the resistance, and that's how you build a volume control. You know, the knob that you adjust the volume with, that's what that is. Well, the output from that resistor, R5, goes back through C7, which is also a large capacitor, polarized, and it feeds back into the biasing network, R1 and R2. It feeds that audio that's just detected back into there, and that audio then couples in through the coil. The coil's an RF coil. It won't absorb the audio. it feeds it right into the transistor. And so now the transistor is not only seeing the RF, but it's also seeing superimposed on top of the RF an audio waveform as well. The audio waveform coming into Q1 causes, because of C3 wanting to hold the voltage nice and stable, causes a tremendous amount of amplification, and that is variation in current on Q1, and T1 is an RF transformer. It doesn't have very much inductance, so the low frequency stuff that is the audio gets coupled into T2. Now T2 has lots of inductance. It's a multi-layer laminate transformer. Has, you know, lots and lots of turns on it. And C4 ensures that the voltage that the voltage change, the audio, is a low enough frequency that C4 can absorb it. But C4 also blocks any RF from going across T2. That's kind of important, because that's how you guarantee that the RF goes across T1 and that only the audio frequency goes across T2. Well, T2 then couples the audio across into the secondary, and there's a capacitor C8 that's a large capacitor, it's polarized, and it passes the audio, which disturbs the biasing that R6 and R7 is trying to provide to Q2. That disturbance in bias causes a subsequent disturbance in current at the collector of Q2. There's a large transformer T3 that then reduces the voltage and increases the current by stepping down the voltage. You start out with a large number of turns on T3 to a small number of turns that drive the speaker, and that reduces the voltage, but it also increases the current, allowing you to have a very, very low ohm speaker, a low resistance coil in the speaker, which is important because they really couldn't make good speakers back in those days that had a lot of resistance on their coils. They had manufacturing problems with wire that fine. So to make sure that they were actually repeatably manufacturable, they used larger wire, which meant that the coil resistance of the speaker was relatively low. So they used a transformer to fix that problem. You know, if you've ever looked at how a speaker is made, it's just a paper, cylinder that's fastened to a paper cone, and you got to wind wire on that paper cylinder. It doesn't take very much to damage it, and so you don't get the chance to wind, you know, thousands of turns of wire onto that thing and hope for it to work properly. Okay, so what I've just done is given you sort of an overview of each of the steps in the circuit, or, well, a thorough view, maybe. Now what I want to do is have you stand back, you know, the artist is painting the picture, and you step out of your reality and you paint the artist that's painting the picture kind of thing, right? Okay, stand back a little bit and look at what this thing does, and it's clever as heck. You have an RF come in. That RF goes through through Q1, gets amplified into T1, goes into the diode D1, rectifies it, turns it into the low frequency audio. That audio gets fed back around, back into the same amplifier that's doing the RF, now as audio, and then it goes in, bypassing T1, on into T2, and then T2 then sends its output, coupled through C8, into Q2 to get further amplified to drive the speaker. That's an incredibly novel idea, that you use a single amplifying device, a single transistor, to handle two. Before that time, they actually had a separate stage in there to do the additional audio amplification. It is a clever circuit, and it shows you how these things relate to one another. Well, I hope it's been an interesting discussion. Oh, I should mention one other thing before I sign off here. Transformer turns ratios. If you have a transformer and you wind, I'm going to pick a number out of the air. It's probably got a not a very good number. But you've got core material, and you take it apart, and you wind 100 turns onto the bobbin. And you filled your bobbin half full. It's important that the windings are roughly equal in size, or you don't make very efficient use of your transformer. So you wind it so it's got 100 turns, and then you wind on maybe 10 turns of some real heavy gauge wire to fill out the bobbin. And you put the laminations together, and now you have a device that has real thin wires coming out one side and thicker wires coming out the other side. If you put, 10 volts on the 100-turn winding, on the 10-turn winding, you will see 1 volt. Okay, if you were able, if you had a high enough frequency and good enough inductance, that you could put 100 volts on the 100 turns, then you'd get 10 volts, which is 1 volt per turn. Every turn of wire, if you put 100 volts on 100 turns on the primary, every turn of wire produces a volt. Okay, so that if you put 7 turns, you get 7 volts. You put 30 turns, you get 30 volts. Put 1,000 turns, you get 1,000 volts. The distinction of whether or not a transformer is a step-up or step-down transformer is to do with the turns ratio. In other words, do you have more turns on the secondary than you have on the primary? Oh, by the way, if you have the same number of turns on both, you get what's called an isolation transformer. That's a 1-to-1 ratio. In other words, it serves no purpose for stepping up or stepping down. It simply reproduces exactly the same voltage on the secondary. And the one thing that a transformer like that is good for is that it isolates. In other words, it creates the same voltage on either side, but the secondary is not electrically connected. If you've looked at your notes, I have a thing on safety and other things that point out the advantages of an isolation transformer. So that's sort of the mystery of a transformer, why the number of windings on each side aren't the same. Well, I hope it's been an interesting lecture, and on to the next one.